all of us, we lawyers, want to be heroes to our clients in the oil and gas practice. We want to be an integral part of our client's success, and litigation lawyers know what it means to be a valued counselor and warrior, and transactional lawyers know what it means to get the deal done. Those of us who practice before administrative agencies, you know, they know what a win looks like. For title examiners, this heroism and success is a little more nuanced. The client thinks they have good title. The best thing you can do for them is to confirm their expectation. Anything short of that means there's curative, there's work, there's threats. So there's rarely a celebration or a closing dinner at the end of a title opinion. For title examiners, the successes start with not being wrong. Over the years, a body of work builds up, and we're protective of that. No title busts on my watch. Second, the title lawyer wants to answer questions and resolve problems and not be perceived as creating problems. So when title lawyers weigh in favor of certainty in land titles, and they do often in amicus briefs and CLE presentations, there's a dual motive. One, don't make me wrong. Don't contradict my body of work. And two, don't hand down rulings that I cannot apply with confidence. Don't make me a cowardly ninny who throws up my hands over and over with the instruments in the chain of title. I've given almost equal time in the paper to fact questions and legal questions. And my proposition to you is that compared to other jurisdictions, Texas titles depend on more fact questions, and we have more legal questions that an examiner cannot resolve without making requirements in other jurisdictions. Even if you don't agree with me, then hopefully you can still recognize the benefits of identifying what the limits are. Typically, a title opinion highlights a group of fact questions. You see that in the second slide. These are usually at the end of the opinion, the final caveats. It's a static list. It's not controversial. These are front and center. But there are others that hover and lurk. Typically, in that same list of caveats at the end of the opinion, there's a reference to the rights of parties in possession. I do want to make a point that's highlighted by the Republic National Bank of Texas v. Stetson case, that it's not just the rights of parties in possession. Perhaps a more insidious risk is the rights of Charlie Stetson, as evidenced in that case. Mr. Stetson was a longtime tenant of Wirt Davis, but he also bought some land, had the right to buy some land. And after Mr. Davis died, there was some title question that maybe Mr. Stetson was more than a tenant. So the title lawyers asked him to sign an acknowledgement of tenancy, and he did so. It says, I'm a tenant. I've always been a tenant. Well, he wasn't. He was an owner. He had perfected a limitation title, and after perfecting ownership, saying I'm a tenant, always was a tenant, does not divest him of the ownership. So if you're dealing with people who are in the process of perfecting a limitation claim, those kind of disclaimers can be effective to interrupt their adverse and hostile possession. But if it's already perfected, you need a conveyance from them. Affidavits, disclaimers don't work if they're owners. And I'll say the same thing about boundary agreements. If you're dealing with somebody who's already perfected a claim, you need words of grant to get that title out of the owner. And continuation of that threat. Once the possession is perfected as an ownership, the owner doesn't have to stay on the land. The McGregor v. Thompson case, after perfecting limitation title, the house burned down, they removed the debris, and the owner moved to town. So if you do a drive-by, a snapshot, you're not gonna see any evidence. There's nothing in the records, there's nothing on the land. This perfected ownership can only be identified with a thorough understanding of the historic possession and use of the land. Obviously, statutes can limit or increase the factual determinations. The most obvious of those is the Recording Act. We'll get to that in a minute, but intestate succession, again, puts Texas out there in other jurisdictions, and I'll pick North Dakota because I know it somewhat. It's like the old baseball joke. One umpire says, I call them like I see them. The other one says, I call them like they are. And the third says, they're nothing until I call them. And that's the way it is with heirs. There are no heirs until the judge determines the heirship. And that's hard on small estates, but it's good for certainty. In Texas, Alexander, see a lot of affidavits, and we've all got a bagload of anecdotes about bad affidavits. Affidavits is somebody's view of the facts, but over and over you find affidavits of heirship that are not correct. Sometimes humorous explanations. Well, yeah, Frank, he's dead to us. That doesn't mean he's deceased. That means he's estranged. We're mad at him. He owes us money. He's in prison, whatever. But anyway, affidavits are just that, somebody's view of the facts. And Texas is full of those kind of heirship issues. Another, old oil and gas leases that have not been released. Your slide may say reported. It should say released.